A word of caution to our listeners. This episode contains references to mental illness and physical harm. Please take care when listening. Pauline holds her phone up close to the Zoom camera and shows me a picture of her hugging her daughter, Corinne. In the photo, Corinne is around 14 years old with long, curly brown hair and a huge smile. She also has a full face of stage makeup on.
That's Corinne dressed up as a dog in for one of the plays that she was in.
Pauline turns the phone back to face her, away from the camera. She pauses, looks down at the photo, smiling.
Superhero she is.
At 14, Pauline's daughter, Corinne, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. At the time, her life revolved around animals, theater, and playing the oboe in band.
She also sang in chorus. I know this sounds, could someone really do all these things? Yes, these were things that Corinne was passionate about and really took pleasure from.
Corinne had a rare and aggressive form of pediatric cancer. And so in March of 8th grade, she stopped going to school during the day and focused entirely on her treatment, doctor visits, chemotherapy, and spending time with her family. At first, lots of friends from school and the Girl Scouts visited Corinne, leaving cards and gifts.
So many pairs of socks, so many blankets, so many journals. Those things just, you know, took over part of our house, just the influx of presents. But really what she needed was a human presence, people, not gifts. What someone needs is someone to stand with them, to be with them, and to make some attempt to have life seem like it's the typical day.
Corinne was in treatment for all of high school, and over time, the visits became less frequent. Her friends were doing their best, but that's an almost impossible situation for a 14-year-old, figuring out how to navigate your friend's terminal diagnosis. And even when Corinne was healthy enough to physically go back to school, she wasn't able to socialize fully because she was immunocompromised. So she had to have her lunch breaks and sometimes do classwork in a separate, smaller space.
She was having a lot of negative thoughts and feeling sad and lonely, concerned about her future. She started to exhibit a lot of anxiety, and some of that would result in physical damage to herself, especially biting her lip, which I take as a sign like that she didn't want to say something.
Pauline was really worried about her daughter's mental health, but it felt like the focus needed to be solely on her physical health, on the progress of Corinne's chemo, and on the status of scans. It was like there was no room for any other concerns. Right from the beginning, Pauline recognized Corinne would need a lot of support.
We're in a little examination room with a bunch of doctors and nurses, and they asked Corinne to leave the room for a little while, and they talked with my husband and I a little bit, just briefly, and they brought Corinne back in. And she said, what would happen if I choose not to have treatment?
Pauline never imagined that Corinne would opt out of treatment. But she understood that Corinne wanted to go back to school, to be with her friends, to play in band and sing in choir. She didn't want to be stuck in the hospital. It was at this moment that Pauline recognized the weight of the decisions and emotions being placed on her daughter. And Pauline had to make sure Corinne wasn't forced to process all of this alone.
It was pretty clear that she wanted help and that she was accepting of getting help.
So Pauline tried to get her daughter consistent mental health support. Corinne had been assigned a psychologist and a psychiatrist when she was diagnosed with cancer. But after a short time, the psychologist moved into a different position and Corinne wasn't assigned someone new. However, Corinne was matched with a psychiatrist from Boston Children's, Dr. Chase Samsel. He prescribed Corinne medicine to help curb the mounting anxiety and depression and met with her on treatment weeks. Eventually, Corinne was also supported with music therapy and a form of talk therapy called DBT, Dialectical Behavior Therapy. These professionals across several organizations, including Boston Children's, were an immense boost to Corinne at many of her clinic appointments.
She learned how to play the guitar and learned how to play the ukulele. And so that was a way for her to help process what was happening with her. Definitely a solid distraction from what was happening.
Pauline was so relieved that Corinne found much needed support.
When something as complex and daunting as a cancer diagnosis comes along, it really shifts your whole perspective. Your thoughts can't help but go to not just a worst case scenario, but many worst case scenarios. It just creates this big crevice in the world that you really fall down into and need a lot of tools to help get back out of.
Pauline had a hard time finding a therapist for herself. She thinks a big part of the problem is resources. There aren't enough available therapists and mental health workers to match the need. But she also recognizes something much larger and more complex is at play. An underlying societal assumption that physical health is more important than mental health.
If you're getting cancer treatment or some other treatment for a major medical condition that's going to be likely chronic or life-altering, it seems pretty clear that your body is connected to your brain. That brain is going to create some emotions, and you're going to need treatment for your body and your brain. Your feelings, your heart, all those things need to be taken care of. There's no easy way to divide that.
And so Pauline is disheartened about the systemic artificial division of mind and body that may have contributed to the insufficient mental health care for her daughter.
It just seems like a void. It seems like something really missing.
Corinne passed away from cancer in June 2019. When Pauline reflects on her daughter's treatment, she wishes Corinne had more emotional support. The trauma of a cancer diagnosis exacerbated feelings of confusion and loneliness for Corinne that are already common among so many teens today. We're in the midst of a mental illness crisis in the United States right now. Countless children and young adults need support as they navigate complex emotions. So on today's episode of Breakthrough, we are going to talk to two doctors at Boston Children's about the mental illness crisis and the myriad of reasons we got here. I'm Zakiya Watley, and this is Breakthrough, a podcast from Boston Children's about the ways researchers are pushing the boundaries of what's possible in children's health. Every episode, I talk to some of the world's top doctors and researchers about how their work is revolutionizing the future of pediatrics and what that means for children and their families. At just 14 years old, Corinne wasn't equipped with the tools to navigate the mental toll of her diagnosis. And unfortunately, Corinne's experience is not uncommon. She wasn't alone in feeling overwhelmed and isolated. This separation of mental and physical health is one of the many reasons we are in a mental illness crisis today. Between 2011 and 2021, the number of teenagers and young adults with clinical depression more than doubled. Boston Children's has made mental health a top priority for research and clinical care. Dr. Stacey Drury joined Boston Children's in 2023 as their psychiatrist in chief. She spent over 20 years practicing as a child psychiatrist and researching child mental illness. I spoke to her about the state of the mental illness crisis today, the origins of the problem, and how her team at Boston Children's is working on a solution. Hi, Dr. Drury. Welcome to Breakthrough.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
As we set the stage for what people should know, I really want to step back and really frame what the background, what the problem is. What do you see in your work that points to a mental illness crisis happening now in the United States?
So we are at a point where a significant percentage of children are experiencing mental distress. We have 30 to 40% of our pediatric visits and our emergency room visits being dedicated specifically to mental health. One of the most striking papers that came out in 2023 is actually a paper looking at life expectancy for children 1 to 19. Since 1990, we've been having increasing life expectancy, much to do and support of all of our changes in our medical care. Starting in 2014, that increase in life expectancy began to flatten. And in 2021, it actually started going down. So one of the strongest pieces of evidence is that our leading causes of death for children under the age of 19 are suicide, homicide and violence, and overdoses. That means that the things that used to be the leading cause of death, accidents and cancer, are no longer the things that are killing children. On average, 12 children take their lives every day. And the way it became visible is because we had so many children sitting in the emergency rooms. At one point during the pandemic, there were over 75 children boarding at Boston Children's Hospital, awaiting inpatient psychiatric care. The state did a wonderful thing and increased the number of inpatient beds, but the problem is that the whole system of care is not in place. If we don't have multiple levels of support, so intensive day programs, outpatient programs, school-based mental health, and most importantly, programs that allow us to identify children who are starting to have behavioral and emotional symptoms early and get them treated, we're not going to be able to solve this problem just by having inpatient beds.
That's such a great point. I know sometimes people on the outside think just adding this one piece into the wheel, will help, but it's an entire system, like you said. I'd like to know if there are other social issues or changes in society, anything that you feel like could also be a contributing factor to this uptick that we're seeing.
Yeah, so it turns out our children are really smart, and we have created a generation of kids that are paying attention. There was a recent study that demonstrated that the things that children are worried most about are poverty, violence, racism, and the environment. And so part of what is happening is our children don't feel safe. And if there's no one to keep you safe, you start to feel depressed, alone, sad, and scared.
Right. And that makes me also wonder, like, who do you talk to? And if there is any stigma around that, that then perpetuates this cycle that we see.
You know, the stigma problem is such a huge component to this. No one wants to talk about it. No one wants to admit that it's in their families. And a great example of this is cancer. So in the early 1940s and 50s, if you got cancer, it was a secret diagnosis. No one talked about it. And certainly no one came to your house and baked food for you while you were going through chemotherapy. And as it became something that was more open, our ability to cure and to treat cancer effectively dramatically increased. You should be as comfortable talking about having a broken leg as you are about having anxiety. So there's an old adage that no one bakes you cookies when your kid tries to kill themselves because no one knows what to say and no one wants to talk about it.
Absolutely. And I can imagine if no one's talking about it, then that only further exacerbates that loneliness for the kids.
Yeah. And we are crushed because we do not have the workforce to support them. And the origins of this problem really come from the very beginning of psychiatry as being separate or thought of as something different than physical illness. So I am a neuroscientist at heart, which means that I absolutely fully believe that all of mental illness is actually neurobiological. So when you get anxious, you feel butterflies in your stomach, your heart rate goes up, you start to sweat. That's biologic. It is no different than diabetes, and yet somehow or other, we've created two completely separate systems. And the majority of mental illness arises in childhood. So almost three quarters of mental illness is present by middle to late adolescence. Our current system, kids are waiting 8 to 12 years of having symptoms before their first contact with any mental health professional. So you have years and years of this neurobiologic connection that has been perpetuated to support anxiety or sadness or depression.
Right. And this makes me think about, you know, I recently saw the Surgeon General made this announcement about the effects of loneliness and how we're seeing increases in loneliness. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I will say this epidemic of loneliness and disconnectedness, I think it is about being able to talk about all of your feelings and not wanting to only present the feelings that make you look good. I don't think that's the fault of social media. I think that's the fault of our culture. Social media can actually be an ultimate connector. And yes, there are bad things that get posted and perpetuated through social media, but it is also an opportunity to distribute information about personal struggles, about times when they had depression. I think a big chunk of this is going to be building parents' own skill sets at how to develop their kids' ability to use social media in a way that is safe and healthy for them. I think we also need to think about how we build connectedness again. So we spent 2.5 to 3 years in some places not being physically close to anybody. And yet we know that behavioral activation and being engaged and being part of a community are the most protective things for mental illness.
I think that is such a good point. We've touched on quite a few different contributing factors to the mental illness crisis that we're seeing. I want to now talk about some of the solutions or attempts to solve some of the troubles that we've just outlined. So first is, what are you all doing? And then what do you feel is unique and innovative about your approach to this?
I will say that the reason that I chose to come here was because I think that Boston Children's is uniquely poised. And I firmly believe that Boston Children's is going to be on the forefront of leading transformative changes through clinical innovation, through collaboration across the country and across the globe, and through innovative research that gets us at the biologic basis of our treatment and approaches for earlier identification so that kids don't have to get mentally ill, that we can address symptoms and deviations from normal development long before we have built-in psychopathology. And so in terms of sort of on-the-ground initiatives that we are currently doing, we are rolling out 2 evidence-based interventions for suicide that can be disseminated in the emergency room. Some of our community-based clinics are building walk-in clinics. So one of the things we often hear is that parents are on a wait list for months and months and years before they see somebody. So building walk-in clinics so that parents can come in and say, hey, I'm really worried, and we can give some advice, get them hooked in before things have gone so far down the path that the child does need to be brought to the emergency room. Building out the ability to start having conversations. Boston Children's Neighborhood Partnership is one of our flagship programs that is working directly in schools and building the capacity of schools to see and identify children that are struggling ahead of time.
I think that's really helpful. You're talking about early identification and education from multiple angles. So it's not just on parents. So my final question is, what do you think needs to happen next at Boston Children's and beyond, right, in the field to curb the staggering increase in mental illness our children in this country?
For me, there's a short-term game and a long game. So the short-term game is that we're building a learning collaborative across the country with different children's hospitals and different mental health leaders in those hospitals and saying, what's working where? And how do I transmit that to where I am? Taking a look at state policies and how things are funded across different states to get an idea of where we need to shift funding and where we need to shift resources. We have to strengthen our school-based programs. The long game is that we really have to get to mental health equity and parity. We have to address stigma. And then, most importantly, we have to build community wellness. We have to shift the model that all of mental health care happens when you're sick. Teaching parents how to be sensitive and responsive and contingent caregivers. We have to stop treating mental health separately for parents and kids. We can't make a mom choose getting her own depression treatment or getting her child's mental health care. And for me, it's also important that we are building a workforce that looks like the community where these children live. I want them to be able to get therapy in their own language with their own cultural values. And when we're treating any illness, be it physical or mental, we have to address the social determinants of health and the barriers that families face. I am never going to be able to get a child fully well if they don't have enough food to eat. And until we really dig in and commit to addressing those social determinants, our treatments are going to be imperfect.
I mean, such amazing things to consider, and especially the co-localization and considering, you know, not having the trade-off between parent and child. I think that's so important. And the social determinants of health and even, you know, just sleep, light exposure, just so many things. I think you've given us so much. But is there anything I didn't ask you that you do think is important?
I would just say that I have a lot of hope And I have a lot of hope because I keep finding amazing people that are creative and committed and share the same mission and vision. And that for me means that we can do this.
So beautifully said, Dr. Drury. Thank you so much again for coming on the show and taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you for having me and for being interested in this really important topic.
Dr. Drury insists that the first step in approaching the mental illness crisis is to understand that mental health is physical health. Once we can comfortably speak about mental health, then we will have the opportunity to make strides in the field similar to the way that our ability to treat and cure cancer advanced once we started talking about it more. The second step, Dr. Drury says, is to try and address the crisis. Dr. Drury explained that for her team, this means researching the biological basis of mental illness so that physicians can catch symptoms and intervene with treatment early. In order to understand this research, we spoke to Dr. Glahn, the chief for research at Boston Children's in the Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Glahn researches how our biology and our environment impact our mental health and the probability of developing mental illness. Hi, Dr. Glahn. Welcome to Breakthrough.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm really excited to talk to you today. The first thing I want to kind of dive into is I'd like our audience to really get an understanding of the mental illness crisis in the United States. I'd like them to get an understanding of the information that you know and what you see. Mm-hmm. And so what sort of data is pointing us to see that there is actually a mental illness crisis?
So in the child and adolescent space, the easiest way to talk about this is the increased rates of suicide attempts and suicide completions in adolescents. So there was recently data that was published by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention that specified that in the 10 years from 2011 to 2021, we had a dramatic increase in the number of children and adolescents that have thought about suicide. We're saying about one in five kids, but it's not equal among all of the children. Females think about suicide far more commonly than males. African Americans are at higher risk for both thinking about and attempting suicide, as are Asians and Hispanics. The highest percentage now is currently among American Indians and Alaskan Natives. You also have a group in the LGBTQ plus community where the numbers are really devastatingly high.
You know, you've given us some troubling numbers, actually. And, you know, your work is to understand mental illness and the biology of it. But these groups don't exhibit some common biology. So why do you think some of these groups are at higher risk?
That is an absolutely amazing question. So the work that I do focuses on genetics. It's not like we have a gene that seems to be more or differentially associated with a particular mental illness in one racial group than another. There's clearly variation across different groups, but it doesn't explain these kinds of differences. Rather, what explains these kinds of differences tends to be the environment. And so questions that come up are individuals in these different groups that I've mentioned, and to what extent do they feel disenfranchised or not part of the larger community that we have, or that they have a sense of hopelessness because they don't see a path forward for themselves? It's important to understand that I'm not just talking about the family home or racism. People too often think about these very important issues and they conceptualize them as being entirely societal. But to me, all of these questions change biology. So for me, I'm interested in what are the biological correlates of social determinants of health that increase risk for mental illness? And how does that play out in the developing mind? We try to understand the genetic predisposition. We try to understand what the environmental component would be, particularly those environments that we know we can model.
I think that is a wonderful way for people to understand the gene and environment kind of requirement. Tell us what some of the primary aims of your lab are.
Okay. So my research focuses on trying to find the genes and environment that influence brain, because for almost all complex disease, it takes both an environmental effect and the genetic predisposition. We know this because you can find identical twins where one of them has the disease and the other doesn't. And indeed, part of the work that I did early on in my career was looking at and studying twins where one of them had schizophrenia and the other one did not, and trying to understand what's different between the two of them. At Boston Children's, I have collaborated with two incredibly wonderful scientists, and the three of us together focus on children with early onset psychotic disorders. So these are kids who are having hallucinations and delusions, hearing things that others do not hear, having very unusual sets of beliefs. And our goal is to study these individuals because it's rarer to see that in children than in adults. And we have a feeling that these kids either have a stronger genetic effect or a stronger environmental effect than what you might see if they were adults that had the same presentation. But also, working with the kids gives us the potential of finding something that could really help and treat children. As part of this, I have a big study going on in Mexico City. I particularly like to work in populations that are underrepresented. And unfortunately, in the United States, we underrepresent Latinos and African Americans and Asians in the work that we do.
I think that's wonderful, both in increasing representation and increasing our models for how we see the onset of this type of illness. And, you know, what do you think is unique or innovative about your approach?
So the program that we have is one of the very few in the world that's focused on this early onset psychosis. We're talking about working with kids as young as 8. At Boston Children's, we're relatively unique in working in that age range. We're also relatively unique in the approach, which is both a larger population approach, meaning we're looking for lots of kids that have these kinds of signs and symptoms, but also in trying to understand individual children in order to better be able to understand how we might treat those particular children. And so we're looking at genetic effects. We're modeling that in stem cells that we can derive from them and try to understand what those genes are doing within a cell, within a neuron derived from that individual. And then we're creating animal models, and we're trying to move us to the point where we would understand what a biological mechanism is that we might be able to target. It's a long haul because there's so much about the brain that we don't know. And so part of the work that I do is just focused on normal variation, because there's a lot that we don't know about the ways that environment affects development or that genetics affects development.
It sounds like you all are doing really amazing work. I mean, you've listed a couple of different model systems. You're in vitro, in vivo. You are doing wide studies, can looking individually. And I think one of the issues in the field in the past has been like noise, you know, noise versus like what's real. And I think all of these approaches are necessary to kind of fine tune that.
Just to build off that statement. One of the things that's happening in the world of psychiatric genetics is that we're doing really, really big studies right now. I think there are 256,000 individuals that were in the last big adult human genetic study of schizophrenia. And that can help you understand at a population level things that have changed. But once your sample sizes get that big, it gets harder to understand what that means for the individual that you're seeing.
Yeah.
And we are still close enough to the individual patients that we're seeing that inevitably that child is in our minds when we're thinking about what kind of scientific approach do we want.
And that seems like such a benefit for that child, right? To be able to leverage learnings from large groups, but also to have that individualized approach to care. And when I think about all these things you've shared with us, I want to know from you, what do you think needs to happen next?
So I think there are three things that are really critical here. COVID shined a light on mental illness in general. And one of the things that showed us is just how much we have underfunded mental illness treatment for the last 50 years. shining that light is important because we don't have enough practitioners. We don't have enough clinicians. We don't have enough hospital beds. A second thing, which is something that my group is working towards and other groups at Boston Children are working towards, is trying to figure out good ways of predicting who is at higher risk and who is at lower risk for mental illness. We can possibly begin to intervene earlier, which has been shown to really improve outcome.
Yes.
Another thing that's really quite unique about Boston Children's is that we have groups of people who are working at the level of basic neuroscience and of clinical neuroscience and in psychiatry and in neurology and developmental medicine. And we all come together in ways that I don't see in other institutions in quite the same way. And that's really important because a lot of the kids, particularly the younger kids, may end up having other presentations. They may end up having a seizure, which makes them being seen by a neurologist, or they may have some of the signs and symptoms of autism before other mental illnesses present. And so being able to have that multidisciplinary approach becomes really critical, particularly as you think about the whole child, as we were discussing before. So from that perspective, I find myself thankful and I feel lucky that I am here in this institution.
Absolutely. Dr. Golan, thank you for sharing that. And also thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
It was great speaking with you.
Dr. Golan and Dr. Drury both emphasized the importance of understanding the biological and environmental components of mental illness. They both identified how COVID shined a light on the United States youth mental illness crisis. And now Dr. Golan and Dr. Drury are on the forefront of finding a solution. Boston Children's is building smart, multidisciplinary teams of researchers, scientists, and teachers to tackle the mental illness crisis. For moms like Pauline, their new approach gives her hope for other kids struggling, like the kids she sees at the high school where she works.
Young people are faced with adult decisions. They're on the brink of adulthood, but they don't have all the tools there. And I think, unfortunately, the pandemic really did alter that. I think the trauma from that is still being played out, how students contended with that loneliness and that change in isolation.
Pauline has seen how life-changing it can be to have access to therapy, medication, and a connection to people, even if it's just to remind you of your love for music.
I think just being in the presence of someone helping make music, even if they weren't creating new songs, the fact of playing the music, focusing on the music, really brought a lot of joy to her.
If you or someone you know is struggling, please call or text 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Again, that's 988. Thanks for listening. A special thank you to the researchers, physicians, patients, and families working with Dr. Stacy Drury and Dr. David Golan to make these breakthroughs in mental health possible. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow, subscribe, and leave us a review. See you next time.